Yogananda makes a very interesting statement. I usually call Yogananda master. That's just the vocabulary of Ananda. Master is Yogananda, Swamiji is Swamiji. Makes it easier, Kriyananda. In the Bhagavad Gita, it says essentially, to the man without peace, happiness is impossible. And it's a very interesting statement, because no matter how much else you have going on in your life, if you don't have that sense of inner peace, as you all were describing, some of you were describing, there's that river of anxiety that just always flows, and no matter where you are, it's a background sound. I was saying to some of you before Carla and Patricia came in that right now in our Ananda family, we also run here an elementary school, children from the age of 4 to 14, and every year one of the things that we do is we put on this huge theater production, which is children's play is not the word for it. It's a gigantic theater production, which all 65 children are in it. It's like an hour and a half, a two-act play. We write this, the collective we. I'll say we, meaning Ananda anywhere in the world, but I don't mean me personally. They write the script and so on. It's a really big deal. For the last 3 or 4 years, I've been doing the costumes for that play, pulling together the costumes, which is a very, very big job. And it takes about 5 or 6 weeks to do it. And it's fun. It's totally fun for me. My ambition, long before I came to Ananda, was always to work with children, which has never manifested at all except this. So it's great fun. But I have to put every minute of my time into it in order to get it done. And I get help, but I mostly do it myself, partly because I find it easier just to do it myself than to have to consult with everybody, but everybody helps me also. I don't want to exaggerate what it is. But it's very interesting because I'm unable to sleep very much, and this is not going to give you much faith in anything else I'm going to say. But, you know, during that time, I don't sleep much because I'll fall asleep, I'll be tired, I'll lie down to sleep, and then suddenly some idea will pop into my head. And just bingo, sleep is gone. You know, it's just like the mind is running. And there we are. And so I have to get up and do something else before I can put myself back asleep again. Because everything is happening internally. You know, it doesn't matter what objective circumstances it are. The only thing that ever matters is the vibration of the mind. Just speaking of that circumstance, I don't really object, because part of what makes it happen, at least I know for me, is that for that project, that absolutely one-pointed focus, virtually obsessive focus, except it's not, it's deliberate. It's not like it's unbalanced, as I know, is that if you don't concentrate like that, you don't have the magnetism to pull in the ideas that you need. It's that determination that pulls in the ideas. But there it is. It's who and what we are. So we're not trying, this is what I want to say, there's two kinds of peace. One kind of peace is the dullness of simply having gotten yourself to a low enough point of energy or to a point of such complete indifference that or so covered over from the experience of life that you're peaceful because you're too dull to have any anxiety. And you see people who call themselves peaceful, but as a rule, they're not inspiring. You know, they may be peaceful, but you don't want to be like them. In a very interesting definition of happiness, Swami Kriyananda was on a radio show in Los Angeles a few weeks ago with a very good interviewer, and she asked him very good questions. And one of the questions she asked him was, "Are you happy?" And it was sort of that was not a very good question in itself, but it prompted a good answer. He sort of stared at her for a moment because it wasn't really how he was thinking, because he had often said he feels so much inner bliss he can hardly speak. So that's a sort of, but just to put it down to, are you happy? And so he gave a definition of happiness. He said happiness is the desire, true happiness is the desire to make everyone in the world as happy as you are, which is a very interesting explanation. Because sometimes people will tell you that they're happy. Are you happy? Oh, yeah, sure, I'm happy. Yeah, everything in my life is fine. I'm a happy person, they'll say. But there'll be no outflow of that happiness from them. There'll be no vibration emanating, and there'll be no commitment of energy on their part to share what they have. Because it's the nature of true happiness to want to share itself. And in fact, Swamiji has also given an interesting definition of why did God create the universe, which people often ask, defining God as Sat Chit Ananda, which means ever-existing, ever-conscious, ever-new bliss. Sat Chit Ananda. Sat, ever-existing, Chit means consciousness, feeling consciousness. Ananda means bliss. Ever-existing, ever-conscious, ever-new bliss. That's the real definition of God. English is a very, very poor language for spiritual discussion. So the word God doesn't have any meaning till you give it a meaning. The Sanskrit word Sat Chit Ananda is just a perfect meaning. But he said it's the nature of bliss to want to share itself. And when we reflect upon our own inner life, we realize that bliss being the underlying reality behind all positive qualities, including love, that it's the nature of it to want to share it. That's why we seek to have a mate. That's why we seek to have children. That's why we seek to have meaningful work. Because whatever there is in us of an uplifting and a happiness-producing nature, it automatically, we want it to flow out of us. So what we're working with, so what I was saying is sometimes you see people who claim to be peaceful or are peaceful in the sense of they're unagitated, but there's nothing flowing out of them. So you can feel that there's no bliss behind that peace. There's no bliss behind the word happy. Bliss, again, English being a difficult language, happy is a very funny word in English because you can be happy because you got revenge on your enemies. You know, you can be happy because the 49ers didn't lose. And these are not like lasting states of happiness. In English, we use the word bliss because it's a little better. The actual word for bliss is Ananda. That's the name of our whole spiritual movement, is Ananda, because that's the quality above all that characterized both Paramahansa Yogananda and Swami Kriyananda as the state of bliss. So that's why they chose that. Bliss is the underlying movement. Now, so what we're looking for, as I was starting to say, is the kind of peace that has looked in the face of all the things that could take that peace away from us and has not tried to hide from them, but has been able to find a reality that is bigger than they are. Now, what we're also talking here is about the level of energy. And, you know, Carla mentioned specifically being very, very active, and all of us have talked about being busy and active here. So it's not like we're sleepy people. And I was talking about being so engaged in, you know, just manifesting in 4 weeks all these costumes, that it's just that energy has to constantly keep flowing. That's the only way, really, to bring about great things. And we bring about those great things because we're happy inside and we want to share it. That's really what's moving us. That's the power of God inside of us as bliss, pushing us outward to do things. So the state of peace that we need is a state of peace that is a transcendent state of peace. Otherwise, it's just a matter of time before some wave of karma is bigger than our peace. You know, because that's what we're dealing with. And this is also the divine plan, like it or not, is that our ultimate destiny, because our true nature, is infinite. And that infinite manifests as us and takes this physical body. Carla describes the fact, has mentioned to us that she has a 2-year-old, is a boy or a girl? A 2-year-old son. Okay, so at a certain point, that son was conceived, and then all of a sudden, this little tiny thing, I have so much fun over the years watching our school children because many of them were used to be tiny, and every one of them got bigger. What, in fact, last night the son of one of our teachers is one of our founding children because he started when he was like 4 years old. Now he's in his 20s, and his his family, his genetic stock is large, so he's a great big man, and he actually, not all of our children stay in our community, but he's joined Ananda in his own way in another city. He's become a friend in his own right, and there he was, this big, hulking, gigantic, strong, powerful man. He was running the video camera last night. There he is. And he used to be really small. I remember him being under the chair and being unwilling to come out, you know. He was that, under the couch, actually. Not that couch, but a very low couch. He could crawl all the way under, and he wouldn't come out. He was also famous. I love this story. His father carried him in once every Sunday. You all haven't seen it, but every Sunday we do at our Sunday service, we have a festival of light, which includes everyone coming forward and receiving the touch of light, which is a blessing at the spiritual eye. And his father was carrying his son in, and I went to bless Brian, the boy, like this. And I don't know, Brian was in a mood. He puts his hands over his spiritual eye to keep me from touching him. He begins to scream at the top of his lungs, right in the middle of the whole service, "No, no, no, no." Which just amused the heck out of me. His father was less amused. I thought it was fabulous. You know, there he was. At least he had his own opinions about things. But there's the part of this that I'm speaking of is that, you know, where does the baby come from? You know, I've never been pregnant, but the women I know who have and have had more than one child tell me from the moment of conception, it's a distinct individual, and each child is different than the others, and, you know, there's no creating this one. This is just who he is and what he is. Because we are an ongoing story. This spark of individuality, and there is a Sanskrit word for it, and the word is jiva, J-I-V-A. We often in English use the word soul, but soul, again, is a confusing word. Jiva is that spark of individuality that endures. It's not our personality, it's not our ego. It's the divinely created individuality, which, according to the masters, some of the things I say, I have to say according to the masters, you know, is always there. Even when the bubble merges back into the sea, there's still a bubble. You know, it's merged back into the sea, but the bubble is still there. That's the jiva. The jiva incarnates life after life, and it attaches itself, becomes identified with the physical body. So the infinite self, which the jiva is the spark of the infinite, becomes identified with the physical body. And as soon as we become identified with the physical body, now we not only the physical body, but the astral body, which is the energy behind it, and the causal body, which is the thought, energy, and matter. These are the three bodies that we have, and all of them have an ego form. The jiva identifies with that specific incarnation. And so if you think about everything that limits you, you realize it's because you've identified with this unique form. Your age, your gender, your nationality, your other relationships, your children, you give birth to them through your physical body. They then have a physical body. If that same jiva lives across the street, you don't have the same relationship to it. But you've identified with your physical body, and therefore everything about that physical body we think of as ourselves because we have identified with it. It isn't us in the sense that the physical, for among other things, I was just speaking of, you know, my friend Brian, who I knew him when he was 2, and now that he's 25 or 26, whatever he is now, he used to be tiny and now he's huge. So this is the physical body. I'm like, what's happened to our physical body? I'm of an age in which I've begun to go way down on the other side of the hill. You know, I'm just older. My face has changed. My body's changed. Just so many things have changed. I'm not the person I used to be. So what am I really identified with? Because who am I really? This is the great secret of age that all my peers tell me, is that, oh my goodness, I guess our parents really weren't as old as we thought they were, because they must have felt like I feel now, which is that this age is not nearly so true as you think it's true. You're just the same one as you go through all the way. but we identify with, and all of this is what limits us, makes us worry about, well, aging, as I was speaking of. It makes us be attached to certain people and have special anxiety for them. Makes us worry about whether we're, where we're going to live, whether we're going to be able to have a job, whether we're going to have success in our careers. All of these worries, because the jiva, the infinite jiva, has identified with this physical body. So that is, and the actual plot of life is to identify not with the temporary, but with the eternal. Now, that doesn't mean, and this is how people get very confused, this doesn't mean that the temporary is not real. Because, of course, it's real. It's all around us. It's happening everywhere. As Yogananda put it just perfectly, he said, on the level of a dream, it's real. In meaning that it's happening on its own level. It's just happening in a context that's bigger. But if you relate to the bigger, you also relate to the smaller. And you don't relate properly to the larger by turning your back on the smaller. And this is a profound quasi, or I should say a profound spiritual misunderstanding that people get into. Oh, I can just be a lazy bum and I'll just call myself spiritual. I'll just do nothing. I'll accomplish nothing. I'll put out no energy. I'll just be peaceful, you know, meaning I'll just put out nothing. I'll just be low energy because I'm just relating to the infinite. But the infinite encompasses the narrow. You have to relate from the center out to everything. From the center of where we are, we have to relate all the way to the infinite, whichever way you're taking it. If the infinite is the beginning and all of this is the most transitory, or if this is the most transitory and we relate all the way out to the infinite, whichever way you take it, still we have to encompass it all. And that is the only path to real peace. Because whatever reality we cannot face with equanimity is still going to be a limiting condition, and sooner or later that limitation is going to catch up with us. Because there is an impelling force within us, which is the force of the river seeking the ocean. Someone asked me once, at what point does the jiva begin to seek to reunite with the infinite spirit? I said, well, when does the river begin to seek the sea? As soon as the river emerges from the earth, as soon as the spring begins to flow, where does it flow? It flows toward the sea. It always does. Because the ocean is what's calling all, it's calling it home. So at whatever point we were manifested, we always remember where we're trying to go and all the longings that we have within us. And we, all of us, every human being is born with these intense longings. You know, the little baby has a longing to be held by its mother, to be nursed, to be fed. We have all these longings, whether they're physical imperatives, you know, for food or sex or warmth or whatever it might be, or whether they're emotional imperatives for understanding, for comfort, for meaningful work, whatever it is, we have all these imperatives, and they're always compelling us. As one of my friends said once, and it was very profound when someone else was just really depressed and upset about some difficult circumstances of her life, her older friend said to her, "Honey, sooner or later you're going to get back into things," she said, "because it's just not that easy to lie down and die." And I've always remembered that, you know. Now, even if you want to just lie down and die, after a while you get hungry. You know, something happens. And it's just not that easy. Because there's these imperatives within us that will not be denied, that force us out again. And even people who are ostentatiously and conscientiously refusing to participate, like, and I don't mean this in a harsh way, like lots of crazy people that you see on the streets who have just decided that the whole project is just too difficult and I'm just going to take a holiday. I'm just going to take a holiday from shared reality and I'm going to just go way into my subconscious and I'm just going to create my own. And, you know, whether it's full of demons or fairies or angels or whatever it is, it's just like, I'm just not going to relate to any of that anymore. I'm just going to relate to this. And it's literally a stage on the spiritual path. It's a stage through your incarnations where you just reach the point where the whole thing is way too much And I'm just going to direct myself toward only the things that I myself choose. And it's not an easy stage to be in, but it's just a stage. And sooner or later, such people will find out that it doesn't work. I mean, the problem with it is really simple, is that it doesn't work. The imperatives within you, you know, for understanding, for love, for comfort, for satisfactory expression of your own consciousness will compel you after one or many incarnations. We tend to play out these things in groups. You know, you sort of, let's try the mental imbalance thing. And so we try the mental imbalance thing for a long time. And when you're finally just coming out of it, you often will just kind of slip in and out of it. It's one that I feel is closer to me karmically than others. So I'm kind of comfortable with mental imbalance. I kind of know what it is. It's just sort of there it is. It's more comfortable. I have a karmic familiarity with it. It just, when I see people who are mentally unbalanced, I kind of understand what they're doing. I'm not a psychiatrist and I've never wanted to be, but I can get it. I get where they are. And it's a turf that I know. You know, you've gone into the physical healing profession because in some part of you, you sort of understand or have dealt with it, or one reason or another, it's a world that you walked into. Are you in counseling, Stacey? So you've gone into counseling. I do a lot of counseling. That's where I express that. You just sort of, you go into a field sometimes where you've had enough personal experience in previous lives that this is familiar turf to you. And you can just kind of enter that world that's not so strange to you. Does that make sense? Yeah. And you also sometimes in one incarnation finish it. Like, you're just like, I'm done with that. You know, I've had nurses or counselors who just feel like, I've done all I need to do there. I'm just not, that doesn't interest me anymore. I've had very little interest in physical healing in this life. Just doesn't interest me. Mental healing interests me. Yeah, but physical healing, it doesn't. It's just like, I've been in that one and I'm not interested anymore. But the jiva just follows through on this process. So once you have come to the point where you've been hearing about the idea of self-realization, self-realization is capital S self, and it means to realize the infinite self, not the small s self, that this little small s self that I'm walking around in is actually just a facade over the infinite self. And we begin to understand that the infinite self is the ocean to which the river of our consciousness is flowing, and until we actually enter in and begin to try to move through that current, we'll always be a little bit frustrated. But we don't learn that by anybody shaking their finger at you and saying, now this is what you really ought to do. We learn that only when our own experience actually tells us so. And for this reason, we have to be very patient with ourselves, and for this reason, we have to be very patient with others. Because we just don't learn from being told. We learn from doing. And it's interesting to watch one's own life, because you'll see there are things that you simply know, and no one can take them away from you. You just know them. You know that this particular action will not bring you happiness. You know that this is a dead end. You can feel the karmic consequences of that particular path. And there's nothing in you that wants to go there. Even if your best friends or people in your family will go there. Maybe it's, you know, toward great wealth or toward fame or toward political influence or whatever it might be. You're either drawn to it because part of you feels that some satisfaction that you're looking for will be found there, and you need to follow that route to the end of it until you hold it in your hand and can say whether it'll make me happy or not. And think of it in very much in the negative. I mean, probably, you know, none of us have committed murder. We haven't committed suicide. We haven't done some really egregious, dishonest thing to anyone. I mean, it may have crossed our mind, oh, look, you know, my brother just left $500 on the table. I could just pick it up, you know, and say that the maid took it. And you probably didn't do that. It may have crossed your mind. It may never have even crossed your mind. But there are many people in the world who would have, because they just would have. They would have thought that that would have made them happy. And no telling them that it won't wouldn't have taught them. But If you've taken that money in a previous life, broken the relationship with your family, faced the consequences, you just remember at the beginning, it's not worth it. This one's not going to work for me. Okay? Now, everything that disturbs our mental equanimity is an unlearned lesson. It's just as simple as that. It's an unlearned lesson. We still imagine that following this particular course of action is going to bring me something that I want. And the way we're going to find out that it won't is that we're going to experience it. Yogananda says, and this is a very interesting and somewhat overwhelming idea, he says, everything that you no longer desire to do, you have done. And you can look at your own life and see the things you've already been through that you've already learned. Oftentimes people will come into Ananda having been through some kind of an addictive cycle in their lives and been through some kind of usually the 12-step programs, you know, and such people, they can really tell you some pretty serious things about what they no longer are feeling to do, what they have done and what they're not going to do anymore. And all of us have been less noble than we are now. And we can think about whether it was only one incident or a whole period of our lives when we did things that we just wouldn't do anymore because we know they're not going to please us. But there's other things we're looking for. Relationships, money, validation in the eyes of the world, whatever it is, because we still really need to have those experiences in order to learn what we need to learn. Now, the state of anxiety, which all of you describe, which I am better at in my life, but I've lived through a lot of, I'm high strung. When I think of my animal totem, I think of the squirrel. I'm very high strung. But you gradually learn what works and what doesn't. And so the process of gaining a greater level of inner peace, I mean, you'll walk out of here with some good ideas, but you're not going to walk out of here with this solved, because you're going to have to really begin the project of understanding where this is coming from, why you're doing it, and the process of giving yourself an alternative experience that will really help you to realize that this is not a desirable one. The most important thing that we have to understand is we tend not to overcome our weaknesses by beating at them with a stick. As Yogananda put it, if the room is in darkness, you can just flail away at that darkness all you like. It won't affect the darkness. But if you turn on the light, then it will dissipate immediately, as if it was never there. And so our inner anxieties are primarily dissipated by bringing into our lives more of the reality that we want to have. And it's not only that it will drive out the other, it will give you a bigger perspective. And then also, in terms of the metaphysics, which I will describe to you, you activate metaphysical laws that will start working in your favor. When I was describing earlier about my own conviction of these teachings and my experience of these teachings, what is so compelling about self-realization is that they are objective principles that are based on objective facts. Some of those objective facts are not self-evident with the senses. When I talk about the chakras and the kundalini and the way the energy flows, it's not like we can pick it up and sort of hold it in our hands and look at it like we can this glass. But with just a little bit of intuition and intelligence and common sense, based on what experience we do have, we can become convinced that these principles are true. And then we become scientists. And what a scientist does is, a scientist has a theory, a hypothesis, that he has strong reason to believe is true. And then he dedicates himself to conducting the right experiment to prove that that's true. When Edison and great scientists have an intuitive understanding of the truth. When Edison was creating the electric light bulb, he was absolutely certain that there was a filament that would work. And he tried, I think he said, like 2,500 or 3,000 different experiments. And everyone around him was telling him, this is not going to work, this is not going to work. He knew it would work. He just knew that he had to keep going until he found it. And then when he found it, you know, he was a genius. But he found it because he intuitively knew it was true and that it was just a matter of putting out the energy to make it happen. In my tiny little world of doing these costumes for the children, which I'll refer to more because I'm just finished with it, it's like somehow as soon as I start that, even if I don't know what the image is, I have enough experience to know that this will work. We're going to be able to do this. We're going to, as I reassure the children when they grab my dress and say, "Where is my costume? Where is my costume?" I said, "No Living Wisdom school child has ever gone naked onto the stage, and no child ever will." And so I promise you, you will have a costume. I don't know even where they're coming from or how we're going to make it happen, but it will happen. And therefore, you just keep putting out the energy, and at the end, it will happen. Now, in the spiritual life, one develops an intuitive understanding at whatever level you're able to grasp that. I mean, your intuition may be global. When I met Swami Kriyananda for the first time at Stanford University, as it happened, he walked in to give a talk there. I'd never seen him before in my life. Instantly, I just knew he was my teacher, and that was that. And I never looked back. I mean, it would have seemed impulsive, but after 40 years, it doesn't seem like it was impulsive. But the decision was intuitive, obviously past life connection. I mean, sometimes people fall in love at first sight because it's not first sight. It's first sight in these bodies, in this life, but it's not first sight. You fall in love with your new baby. People think that, you know, that's because it's come out of your own womb, but you fall in love because it's an old friend. Oh, look, there you are. And sometimes it's an old enemy. It has to be said. One woman friend of mine gave birth to twins. One was an enemy and one was a friend. You think that wasn't a difficult mothering? Because antipathy also pulls you together because it's an obsessive preoccupation with one another. And sometimes Yogananda said, you're born into the people that you've fought with in the past so that you can fight it out in close quarters, is how he put it. I mean, it's... We can't be too romantic about this. There's just people coming together. Even if the baby is small, it's a full-grown, it's a fully developed soul. It's not. It's just in a little body. It has all the karma of many lifetimes. But you fall in love because it's an old friend. And also God puts that in there because otherwise the effort to raise the child would be too much. You just would leave them somewhere else. But there's that draw, and so you can't. But sometimes your intuition comes on a very large scale and you take everything that falls under that umbrella. Sometimes you build your intuition step by step. When people are first entering, as you are, this path of self-realization, I always say to them, just don't take my word for anything. I will present it to you as clearly as I can with all the conviction I have. So at least perhaps you will think, well, she doesn't seem to be stupid and she seems to believe it, so let's sort of see, maybe there's something there. But you can only act from what you yourself intuitively know. You can only conduct the experiment if you believe in the hypothesis. And so the experiment that we're working with here is to transcend the ego identification, really to transcend the ego, but that's a very confusing word for people. So to transcend the identification with limited realities, to define yourself by a greater reality so that you can encompass the smaller realities without it filling the space of your consciousness so completely that you have no other reality to balance it. Does that make sense? So that's exactly what we're working with. The difficulty is not that you're concerned about certain realities. I mean, to a certain extent it is. Why should you worry about things you can't control? But the difficulty is that aspect of your consciousness fills all the space of your consciousness. You know, if you have a child to take care of and you're a little bit concerned about, is that baby well today? Is the babysitter taking care of him properly? You know, how am I going to earn the $90 needed to get his hearing aid or whatever it might be? I mean, those are real concerns. You're responsible. You have to think about them. But they become a detriment when they fill your consciousness. And there's no dynamic, creative potential to deal with those situations because it has become everything. So the answer is not even necessarily to change that reality, but to give yourself enough perspective and space around it, that it becomes just a small part of what you're doing instead of the whole of what you're doing. If you have a white sheet and there's a black spot on it the size of a quarter, if you stand across the room, you see the black spot. It hasn't changed. It's a situation that still has to be dealt with. But you see it in the context of a wall-sized piece of white, and it's perfectly doable. But if you walk up and you put your eye right against that quarter-sized piece of black, maybe you'll be able to see a tiny little spot of white with the other eye, but still that black is just going to define your reality. So that's another way of saying we don't play games. A woman friend of mine, her husband left her for another man, another woman. And she felt, naturally quite devastated by that experience. It was a very complicated situation of good people getting themselves into a difficult situation. So everybody behaved as honorably as they could in the circumstances. So it was difficult. And when she was trying to get over it, she said something to Swami Kriyananda, and she offered him sort of what people say. Well, everything was perfect. He really did, just what he had to do. It all just happened in the best possible way. Swami said, no, it didn't. He said, it was not a good thing that he did. He said, you can't comfort yourself with fantasy. He said, you have to be able to look right at it. It was not a good thing that he did, but he did it. So look right at it, see what he did, he said, and then transcend it. But it is what happened. And, he's a good man, he's an honorable man, he was just caught in a situation he couldn't handle. And this is what happened. And she herself had faults in the situation also. And this is what happened. Look right at it. And then raise your consciousness so that you can see it in perspective. You see what a huge difference that is? But that's why self-realization is not a shortcut. But when you have those kinds of inner tools, and I'm going to give you a break and then we're going to talk about them, then you really have something. Because if you know how to surf, within reason, you can go wave after wave. If you only know how to do one tiny thing, then as soon as something else happens, you're completely, quote, at sea again. But if you know how to, let's use the word skiing better, if you know how to sort of go down the hill and anticipate and respond, then you really have something. If you can only go down one little tiny route, then as soon as the route changes, you're stuck. I'm saying all this because if you become convinced of the efficacy of the principle, then you will be inspired to put out the energy to develop the ability. Otherwise, you'll just look for something else. So let's take about a 10-minute break. There's a bathroom right through those doors. And if you also want to go downstairs to get more hot water or is coming to a higher state of consciousness, and one of the things that happens in a higher state of consciousness is that differences dissolve, because you begin to live behind appearances. And so in a lower state, appearance is everything. So different culture, different skin color, different language, that defines everything. But in a higher age, just as we're talking about, you're defined by what's behind it. And all of these become charming, interesting things. But also what happens literally is that cultures dissolve. And in higher ages, there's a world culture. Of higher ages, I'm talking about over a period of some thousands of years that this takes place. But that's what you're seeing now. You're seeing a world culture come in, if you travel at all. First of all, English is becoming, even though people resent it, it's still, English is the language that everybody speaks in the world. I've traveled all over the world, or to a large places. I don't speak any language but English, but usually you just start speaking English and somebody will start talking to you back in English. Everybody's dressing the same, and in horrible ways, the culture is becoming the same. It's Coca-Cola, it's McDonald's, and everywhere you go, and somebody said the most globalized product in the world is those little rubber flip-flops. Everywhere you go in the world, you'll see rubber flip-flops. Even in the most poor countries in the world, they're all wearing rubber flip-flops. It's just like, you know what I mean?
Yeah,
it's just like, And a lot of the culture is awful right now, but what's happening is that there's a channel of unity that's going out. And as the consciousness gets higher, that channel of unity, and I mean, just look at, I'm old enough to remember that when Swami Kriyananda went to for 4 months in India in 1977, we wrote letters on, you know, little flimsy stuff, and there was a tremendous confusion because letters would be lost, it would take so long to get them by the time he would be answering, and every so often we'd have some shouted phone call over these really terrible phone lines, you know. And now when he lives in India, I write to him, he answers me in 1 moment, you know. I send him an email, he sends me an email back. I remember when we started faxing, how thrilling that was. You just put the piece of paper in and it would come out in Calcutta, and then, you know, they would have that answer. And but now it's like all that space is just dissolving. And to a certain extent, the time involved in traveling through that space is also dissolving. You really, it's a complete change because the planet's all the same. And that's one of the reasons why all this awful stuff is being exported and imported. But over time, it's going to turn into something else because it's all part of this rising energy. And then, you know, cultural differences are just going away. People, national dress, wherever you go, there's no charming national dress, except every once in a while people show up in something for a special occasion. But everybody walks around basically in jeans and rubber-soled shoes as a rule, you know. Americans wear white ones, as they say. American tourists travel around the whole planet in white athletic shoes. Actually, after 9/11, they actually told Americans, if you're traveling abroad, don't wear white athletic shoes because it will mark you as an American. It's ridiculous. I started watching and I realized it was true. It's comically true.
These people are also sitting like walking in conference when you were like,
yeah. Yeah, we're wearing sneakers, and but it's just, it's a funny, it's a very good time to be here.
My friends who live in Europe, that are from my country, uh-huh. They used to say they know they're American because most of them are old, you know, they're tourists.
Uh-huh.
Because in Europe, most of the travelers are younger whenever they go to Africa.
Uh-huh.
They're like right after high school.
I see, that's true.
So uh-huh. The people that travel are old.
Yeah.
Slow. I'm like, and then they start talking about all the vacation, how short it is, and you have to be old for you to have all the years.
Yeah, no, it's all that is the truth. It's a funny thing. Well, okay, do you have any questions or comments about anything that we've talked about so far? Any thoughts? Don't be shy.
Can you define the word equanimity? You used it a couple of times. I want to make sure I
understand what I mean. Okay. Obviously, your English is superb, but if it isn't your first language. Equanimity means, I would say, a sense of balance about what's happening. Equanimity usually means calmness. But when I speak of that, I just mean having a balanced sense of what's happening. Even when... Equilibrium, that's the origin of the word. So everything is balanced, which may mean that you have a tremendous effort that has to be put out, but nonetheless it's balanced by a faith that you're going to be able to do it. So I'm not talking about a state of non-action at all, but it's just where everything is in a state of balance. One of the elements, okay, let me think one where to go for the moment. One of the ways to have peace and to have peace of mind... excuse me, is there any other questions or thoughts before I go? Nothing? Okay. One of the ways to have peace and to have peace of mind, I realize I was answering my own question by saying that, is that faith is an important aspect of peace. And when I say faith, I don't mean a kind of passive faith that God will take care of things. Faith is as much faith in your own ability to meet the realities that life sends you as it is faith in somebody else taking care of it for you. Swamiji writes these aphorisms. He wrote this book called Living Wisely, Living Well. It's a very good book. It has 365 phrases, words of advice for every day of the year. It appears on my Google homepage every day, so I get to see it every day. One of the recent ones was, you can't really have faith in life, because life is very, very uncertain. What are you going to have faith in? You'll have faith in the fact that you don't know what's going to happen tomorrow. I mean, that's not really any kind of useful faith. But you can have faith in the fact that life itself is a purposeful journey, and that I have within me the ability to make that journey a successful one. When I was first married, I had been single for a long time, and I really had not intended to marry again, but I found my husband irresistibly attractive, and that was just sort of the end of it. That was the end of the resolution like that. And, you know, almost 30 years later, it was probably not a bad decision. I say that facetiously. It was a wonderful choice. But having been single for a long time, I was quite determined not to allow what I was all too familiar with, which was feminine emotionalism, to just, you know, mess up the friendship we had. But I was very impressed one particular day to just watch myself just act out this whole sort of emotional scene over nothing at all. And it was almost literally that I just sat on the couch in our house and he just went about his Saturday morning life, and I became gradually more and more upset with him, which women can do. As a woman, I say that because I know that we can do that. You know, man is just calmly doing whatever he does without any awareness that she's, you know, slowly flipping out over probably what he's not doing or who knows what. But anyway, I was doing it. At the end of which, I managed to create a bit of a blow-up. And after it all solved itself, I thought, that's so ridiculous. You know, where did that come from? And I realized it came from the fact that I was very much engaged emotionally with his reality, and so every nuance of his reality affected my emotions. So there's one, here's a really good solution. I'll just be less involved. You know, I'll just pull my energy back. And that, unfortunately, is the solution that many people make, whether it's in any kind of a close situation, family, romantic, whatever it might be. It's too painful to be really open, so I'll just be a little more closed. And then I won't suffer as much. But that is exactly what I was talking about earlier, where you get peace by sinking. And so, therefore, you're still vulnerable because something's going to crack that open sooner or later, and then you're going to have to face what you were afraid to face. So I tried to make myself safe. So I didn't want that. So I tried to make myself comfortable by assuring myself that I'd married a good man, that, you know, he was going to take care of me, all the things that people say, I can trust him, all these words you want to use. But I was also mature and realistic enough to realize that I know myself, and I obviously am a person of high intentions and a degree of refinement, but you just don't know what's going to happen. You know, you just don't know what kind of karmic wave is going to come over you. You don't know what tests you're going to have to face. I mean, things happen. One of my friends, she was born, a contemporary of mine. Right after she was born, her father, who was Italian, was doing an assignment in Italy. The war broke out. He was an Italian citizen. He was in Italy. And for 5 years, he couldn't get back. And so all of a sudden, the mother's left alone with a new baby. You know, just like these things happen. And 5, 6 years later, when they're finally reunited, she has to start all over with a relationship. I mean, you know, just things happen. So in my own heart, I had to think, you know, if I put my faith in this other person, one, it's unwise, even if it's justified as far as you can justify it, it's unwise because he doesn't have control over life and death. What if he gets sick and dies? Secondly, it's an unbearable burden to put on someone else. That, you know, I feel secure because you're going to come through for me, aren't you? You know, that's not really attractive. Also, it's not really love. It's just self-interest. It's like, now you make me feel better and you're always going to make me feel better. So there we have it. We are all set, aren't we? That's not a really good basis. So I decided that there was one thing that I could trust. And what I could trust is the principle that whatever comes to you in life, God will also give you the strength to be able to deal with it. Now, for me, that was a principle that I could trust at that point, because I had done enough inner work and lived with my eyes open for long enough that I really knew that even if difficulties came to me, if I held fast to the ideals that I believed in and to the principles and practices that I was learning, then I would be able to get through them and the end of them would be positive. Now, this is very similar to what I was talking about my friend who found herself suddenly without a husband, not expecting that. And her way of trying to fix it was to say that it was all okay, and Swami's response to her was no. But the fact that it is okay for it to have happened is because if she responds to it according to the principles and practices of self-realization, then the end result of that will be an expanded consciousness for her. And therefore, it will be good. Now that's, you see, dealing with, not with fantasy, but with truth. So at that point in my marriage, I made the decision that I, of course, trusted him, but what I really trusted was that God would give me the experiences that I needed and give me the strength to face them. And if you have that thought in your mind, then you see, you've pulled the rug out from the basis of anxiety of any kind. Because no matter what it is, if that's the attitude that you've cultivated, that is the, you might say, the generic response to every single difficulty. And you see also how it takes the pressure off of the world around you, whether it's the people or your job or your home situation or your country. You know, you've come from a country that was in turmoil for a lot of different reasons and been through a lot of different things. We in America have not had to face that. But even your country, even the environment you live in. We had an earthquake here. It was now, like, you know, quite a few years ago, 20-some years ago or more. But that was a very, very notable moment. I was inside a building. The building started shaking. My subconscious mind said, the problem is the building is shaking. Just get outside. So I went outside, and the earth was shaking. And I was, even in the moment, and I cannot say that I responded in a way that I'm proud of, it was so startling to have the earth shake. Because one thing you really rely on is it just stays there, you know. And when it isn't staying there, such a big part of you is just completely undone. You don't know where to go, literally, physically. You don't know where to go. Well, we're outside, and it's just as bad as it was inside. But it was also very interesting. It was more interesting in retrospect than in the 1 minute that it lasted. But if there is nothing that can be relied upon, except the fact that there is a power and a presence within us that will give us the strength if we get in the habit of tuning into it. Now, years ago, I asked Swami Kriyananda a particular question that was always a conundrum for me. It had to do with my Jewish heritage, being born right after the Second World War, when of the concentration camps and so on. I don't have a clear sense of having actually been in one of those concentration camps, so I can't separate culture from karmic memory. I've always expected to end my life in a concentration camp. It's a peculiar thing, the way the mind works. I don't expect it now, but for most of my life I did, and it would affect me in great ways. Well, there's no point really in investing in really nice things, because in the end they'll take them all away from you. I mean, really. So it's just like I never really thought about having very much, because I always assumed in the end you would lose it, which is actually, spiritually speaking, it didn't frighten me particularly. It was just a fact. But I used to visualize myself in those situations a lot, and I always had this problem, which is, if I'm here, and I'm sure you've read books or seen movies about this sort of thing, and there's a person next to me, and some sadistic person is brutalizing this person next to me, do I intervene? In other words, do I throw my life away in a lost cause because it's important to try? Or is it better to just refrain and let destiny take its course and not act? And it was just a moral dilemma I was always confused about. And I finally, one day, I met Swamiji, and I thought, this is somebody I can ask. So I asked him this question, and he said, what you're really asking, he said, it is a conundrum, because perhaps if you interfere, it might cause grief for everyone. It's not your own life you would be throwing away, but you could be causing problems for everyone around you. you know, it may be better just to keep the problem narrow rather than making it for hundreds of people. He said, so what you're really asking is, in a moment of crisis, how do you know, and we just talk, how do you know what God wants? You can also say, how do you know what is the highest path? How do you know what your superconscious wants you to do? How do you know intuitively what's right? However you define those words, it's the same thing. How do you lift above the obvious to a higher level of understanding? He said the only way you can know in a moment of crisis is if you have practiced when it is easier. In other words, if your lifelong habit is to panic and just go into ego mode, you'll panic and you'll go into ego mode. If your lifelong habit is to have been constantly trying to turn your attention to a higher dimension, then when pressure comes, you will go the direction you have always gone. And that, we cut grooves into our consciousness. And your consciousness is very much like a marble on a smooth surface. I mean, thinking of yourself as multidimensional. Your consciousness is a marble, and your awareness in any moment is a very smooth surface. And basically, the marble rolls whichever way the ground is tilted. And even if the ground is tilted only slightly, the marble will still roll in the direction of the tilt. I had a very interesting experience when I turned 36. Spiritual development often happens in 12-year cycles. This is an astrological, and this is a phenomenon of astrology, which is where you are when you're born. The everything in your horoscope moves around in a 12-month cycle. So, especially the position of Jupiter, which represents the guru. I'm not an astrologer, but the position of Jupiter is the guru in your horoscope. When a Jupiter cycle is completed, it's been through all the signs and it comes back, then you finish the whole cycle and you start again. So often if you look at your life, you'll see that every 12-year cycle is a significant change. So when you're around 36, around 24, tremendous number of people of my generation came to Ananda when they were 24. We just, you know, we were all the same age and we just moved there. I moved like a month before my 24th birthday. That was just my time. When I turned 36, I felt this remarkable total change inside of me that was almost invisible. And it was this. I said to Swamiji, I feel like my subconscious mind has been working against me my whole life, that my subconscious sense of reality was always a little bit anxious. And so the marble of my consciousness would always roll toward this anxious anxiety response. And I feel like all that's happened is it's tipped this much. But it's tipped this much in the opposite direction. And now, after 12 years of very serious spiritual work, the marble rolls toward a more positive response. I mean, a positive self-expectation. I've always been an optimist. But just this tiny, tiny bit of confidence began to develop. It took 12 years of serious work to tip it from the thought that, oh, I can't do it, to maybe I can, right? But that took place on an everyday cycle. So talking very specifically now about what all of you have described, you have to realize that every single thought that you think is significant. Now, I'm not trying to make you even more anxious. Yeah, but it's like every time you put out energy, it digs a little groove. Just like that. One summer at Ananda Village, I never really worked seriously in the garden, but we used to grow a lot of food, and we would all take turns helping out. You know, you'd spend, we'd start these every summer, we'd start this. Everybody spends a half an hour in the garden every morning, which would last a few weeks, and then we'd all stop doing it. But because I wasn't skilled, they gave me this job, and they were doing a furrow watering, where they were putting water in at one end, and then the water had to run down the furrow. But the furrow would always get blocked by little leaves or little rocks. And so my job was just with this small tool just to keep the furrow open. And it was very interesting because the water really just didn't care where it went. It had no sense of responsibility to the plants. It would just go in whichever channel was open to it. So if the furrow, if the hillock of the furrow was broken, the water would just flow off and just be dissipated into the field, into the nothing field. If there was a little rock, it would also just sort of back up and then knock the furrow wall over. So I just had to keep it always open. It was such an incredible analogy to me because I could see how the flow of my consciousness would go wherever the channel was open. And if many days and days of constant self-doubt, I would dig furrows of self-doubt. So as soon as the water would begin to flow, it would flow down self-doubt because it didn't care. It would just go wherever the channel was open. And so I began to realize a couple of things that are absolutely vitally important. And this sounds so simple, but if you can really believe this, I mean, no one here is going to open the window and step out of the window. Because we all know, absolutely, that if we step out the window, we're going to hit the concrete, and that would be a really dumb thing to do. So even though you might be able to get out faster by going out that window, you're going to go around by the stairs. Because our experience has told us that's the way to get out of this building, not out that window. If you were from another planet in which gravity didn't have such a hold, and you landed here and you wanted to get out, you could step out. But you would smash because you didn't know. So we are of the habit of thinking that it doesn't matter. We can just let our minds wander. We can just think these things. We can just let them run. Now, some of those flows of water and holes in the furrow are huge. And our capacity to stop them are kind of small, like, don't think this way. You know, please don't think this way. You know, it's just like, it just doesn't do anything. There's no, you don't have the power yet. So, Swamiji's advice to practice when it's easier, you have no idea how potent that is. Because your capacity to have right attitude is of a certain size right now. And some of your wrong thoughts are smaller or just barely larger than your capacity to have right attitude. And if we conscientiously and unequivocally fight every battle we have a chance of winning, or hold out as long as we can before the flood overtakes us, what we do is we really build the muscles and we start digging new furrows. And we think it's not going to make any difference, but it makes an astonishing difference. And another aspect of this is the way Swamiji puts it, we also always think that the way to overcome the things that are weak in us is to just keep pounding on them. But actually what we do is we go with our strengths. We go with that which already flows for us, and we practice that more and more and more, and use that to build in us the confidence and the experience that I can do this. And then what we find is that we find growing within us because accomplishment and success are really the same in all fields. They're basic principles. When the school that we have here now, which is now, this is its 19th year, which is amazing. David and I actually were integral in starting that school with the help of particularly one extremely talented teacher named Barbara Rabin, who recently transferred and moved to another city. But David actually had experience as a school teacher. I never had any. But David and I are entrepreneurs. We know how to start something. We know that you can look at the spot in the rug and realize you can build a school there. We know how to do that. And there's a certain level in which all entrepreneurship is exactly the same. And it doesn't matter what the project is, there's just a method for manifesting, so to speak. So for 7 years, actually, we were integral to that. The telephone where you would dial the number that was out all over the area for, we called it Ananda School then, now it's called Living Wisdom School, was actually on my kitchen counter. It was like a phone line we put into our house. We didn't even have a school office, but every time that phone would ring, I would pick up and I would say, "Hello, this is Ananda School, Asha Praver speaking, can I help you?" Like this. You know, I'd be covered with flour in my apron, you know, but I'd always, like, there I was Ananda School in those, until it really turned into a school. At which point, I didn't have any idea how to run it, and David wasn't interested, and we found a friend, one of our friends in Portland, Helen, Purcell, who's the director of the school, we literally went up to Portland and I fell at her feet and I gripped her shoes and begged her to move to Palo Alto because we really needed a teacher, a school director at that point, and she was capable. But what I'm saying is we didn't know anything about schools, but we had full confidence that we could manifest, right? Now, what we need to learn in our lives is we need to have full confidence that I can do it. Yogananda actually gives very interesting advice. He says, if you're faced with a test that you know you're going to fail, he said, run away. Because you don't want to reinforce in your mind the idea that you can't face things. He said, you'll have to face it eventually, but if you know it's more than you can do, wisdom says, try to avoid it. Of course, if you can't avoid it, that's a lesson in itself. But if you can avoid it, because what we need to do is we need to develop an understanding of the principles of success. And the more success we have, the more we believe in those principles. When I was first at Ananda Village, the village is the first community of Ananda, the only one that existed in 1971 when I started. Within a month, I had a great interest in food and nutrition. I was a fanatic. Let's just use plain English. I was a food freak, which was very common at that time. And I ended up in the kitchen. I could not cook in the sense that I had no idea how to make food enjoyable. But I was interested in health and organic, and which was all very unusual then, but now it's quite common. And this very competent woman was in charge, but 1 month after I started being her assistant, she had a family emergency. She literally packed up in the night and left, and I was left in charge. And I had plenty of energy, and I was young, and I was enthusiastic, and I could do it. I started cooking, and at that time, a large part of our community was in this one isolated section. There were about 40 people. Nobody had their own kitchens. Everybody had to eat in the kitchen that I was running. And, you know, much of what I cooked was just unpalatable. It was perfectly healthy, but it just had this completely uninteresting taste to it, which I was unconscious of at the time. And at first I just ignored that, but then there was a sort of a revolt among the community citizens. They went to Swamiji and it was just like, you know, we have to eat and she just cooks horrible. By that point I'd begun to realize that I was cooking badly, but I didn't know how to deal with it. I just didn't know. Even when I would try to follow recipes for some reason, I just couldn't make food taste good. So Swamiji, this is about his leadership, he started very slowly with me, just like, you know, that casserole the other day was a little bland. He said like that. I responded, yes, I thought it was going to come out good, and it just didn't come out well. I don't know why it didn't. He said, a lot of what you cook is a little bland. Yes, sir, I know that. And I showed him that I myself was interested in changing. I just didn't know how. So he said, well, maybe I'll teach you how to cook. And I was extremely eager. Now, this is a little side story, but it's a very interesting one. As it happened, that about a week later, this Swami from India was coming to visit. He was a huge fat man, really a big fat man, who loved his food. And he was staying with Swami Kriyananda for like 3 days, and Swami was hosting him for all three of those days. And three meals a day had to be cooked for this man, and they had to be notable meals because of his nature. And so Swami Kriyananda had me there, and he cooked, and I helped him for 3 days. When we went in to do it, I went in with a notebook and a pencil. You know, I thought he was going to teach me how to cook. I didn't know what that meant, but I tried to take notes. And Swami's a cook like this, you know. How about a little of this? Oh, that looks like a little too much. We'll balance it with that. Let's throw this in. What else is in the refrigerator kind of cook? And I was totally bewildered. I just didn't even know how to begin to learn how to cook from the chaos in front of me, but I sort of had enough common sense that I just put down the notebook and I just flowed with him. I cooked with him from Friday night to Sunday night dinner, and on Monday morning I knew how to cook. I have no idea. He just imbued me with the intuitive consciousness to sense how food needed to be cooked. Now, for me this was fascinating because In the family that I grew up in, I mean, my mother cooked well enough, but we were entirely intellectually oriented, and nothing that wasn't an intellectual pursuit was valued at all. So being a good cook was just never, it was never important. So all of my enormous self-concern and tremendous anxiety about accomplishment did not apply to cooking, because it was totally, didn't make any difference. So I didn't block the experience with all of my usual things. And it was the first thing that I ever learned to do in an intuitive manner, because it didn't matter. And I've always had this really ridiculous relationship to cooking, in that, you know, I'll put something on the table and I'll say, oh, this meal is so good, you'll just love it. And I cooked it myself, you know, like you would think that there would be some, at least attempt to be humble. But because it's always seemed unimportant to me, it's never occurred to me to have any self-worth issues related to it. Now, not everyone is going to have such a bizarre and odd opportunity. But the principle there was a very valid one, which is I sort of did an end run around all my self-concern by developing the capacity to learn how to act intuitively in an area in which I wasn't afraid to fail. And so it was the beginning of my realizing, and I have applied that to many areas in which it was unimportant to me, until gradually I've inched into the areas that are important to me, because I've begun to have the experience that it will work out. You know, the costumes that I do here, the first time I took it on, I astonished myself. My, I can really do this. And people will say, well, where do the ideas come from? How do you figure it out? I don't know. I have no idea. Because it didn't matter. And by this point, which was just a few years ago, I understood that if you just follow these certain principles, then it will work for you. I practiced when it was easier. So if you have major areas of anxiety in your life, major things that you're worried about, major habits, you will find that same thread is present also in things that are quite unimportant. I mean, a woman came to me once and she was just absolutely eaten up with anger at her mother, who had, you know, been a mother. And she had, having the ability to produce a baby does not automatically produce perfect consciousness. So the mother had had flawed consciousness and she'd acted it out on her child. I mean, you know, she wasn't a movie script horrible mother. She was just an ordinary woman who had a child and did her best. But the daughter had just responded with this way over the top mountain of anger at this woman. Karma, probably. Probably in some previous lifetime she'd been really horrible. But I asked her, I said, do you have a tendency to sort of become angry and resentful about anything else? First she said, oh no. And then she thought about it for a minute. I said, well, you know, like what about small things? Like you're on the freeway and some driver does something stupid. Oh yeah, you know, I have no tolerance for that. What about one of your coworkers maybe who eats your sandwich out of the refrigerator, you know, or whatever it is? And when she started reflecting on it, she realized that what she considered to be singular, which was her response to her mother, was actually the way she responded all through her life. And I just said, let's forget about your mother for now, because the mother was just this mountain that she just couldn't climb. But I said, let's go around to the plains, and everywhere that you are continually digging the same groove of when anything happens, the marble of my consciousness rolls right down into anger and resentment, because that's the furrow I'm always digging. I said, let's stop digging. The first law of holes is to stop digging, right? If you find yourself in one, you just put down your shovel. So if you find yourself in a tendency to be anxious, start training yourself not to be anxious when it really doesn't matter. And strangely, you'll begin to get faith, you know, that things do work out. Oh, you know, I'm not sure I'm going to be able to get back to my office in time. You know, this line here at Starbucks is so long, and I just don't really know if I can get the coffee or not. I mean, that is what we'll do. You know, we'll become really nervous, and then you just stop and you say, I've got 15 minutes. It takes 2 minutes to walk back. You know, there's only 4 people. I'll time how long it takes them to do an order. Whatever it takes in your mind, or to just more generically, just retreat back into a prayer, a mantra, a chant, your own breathing. I mean, these are all very simple things to do. It's impossible to have a restless, anxious mind and an even, deep, diaphragmatic breath simultaneously, because the breath and the mind are completely tied to each other. And if you consciously calm the breath, I was on a radio show once and this man says, I just don't have time for any of these practices. I said, do you breathe? He said, yes, of course I breathe. I said, well, how you breathe has a great deal to do with how stressed you feel. And if you practice with it, and you have to take some time to learn, where your breath comes from, how fast your breath is running, and just the ability even to do just even counted breathing, just breathing up and down, and watching the breath, just being with the breath. One spiritual teacher once, he gave a whole lecture, and the whole lecture was just about the fact that you're always breathing, and that everything in life, everything comes back to whether you're breathing or not. And then it comes back to how you're breathing. It's a very interesting approach. Life, death, sickness, health, financial disaster, war, peace, it all comes back to whether you're breathing and how you're breathing. And he said, if you take care of the breath, everything else in your life will automatically take care of itself. Because if you take care of the breath, you take care of the consciousness. If you take care of the consciousness, not only is your general experience more positive, but if your consciousness is where you want it to be, your consciousness will create the magnetism to draw to you the solutions to whatever you're having to face. And that's where the faith comes that something will always happen. And that will always happen in a way that will help you. Now, does that make any sense? Mm-hmm. Comments, thoughts, questions?
Makes a lot of sense to me. My biggest trap is self-doubt.
Mm-hmm.
And I see, like how you're talking, I reinforce that with my thoughts. So I definitely see how what you're talking about makes sense. Start with small things.
Start with small things. And here's another thing to realize about self-doubt, which, I fought this battle for a long time. I'll be 64 this summer, so I've had a few more years on you guys than this. Believe me, I have been there. I've been there for decades. I know where that is. It's not easy. Because it's just a big story. But one thing I really finally learned is that allowing your mind to go down those fear-based channels is like taking a cobra and putting it into your vein and inviting the cobra to send its poison into your skin. If you were somewhere, well, let's say rattlesnake in America, you're walking along, and I used to live where there were rattlesnakes. It's no joke. Rattlesnakes are really serious. And when you meet one, whoa, that is one evil creature. He does not have like a pleasant, happy vibe. They're mean and they're dangerous. We used to have a policy of killing them, which would upset people, but Master said it was the right thing to do. They're dangerous. One of my friends doesn't have a finger anymore because he moved a baby rattler. The baby rattler bit his finger, and he's lucky he's alive. They just had to take off his finger. But if you get bit by a rattlesnake, when he got bit by that rattlesnake, it wasn't like, oh, well, let's have lunch and then we'll do something about this. It was, they were out in the country, and it was, we get in the car now, we race to the hospital, we phone the hospital. This is a big deal, because immediately, though, baby rattlers are more potent even than older ones, and it was not clear what was going to happen. So we have to realize that when we start having thoughts that are affirming the source of our misery, we are in an emergency. We are in a life or death emergency, and we don't just kind of casually let that story play itself out. Because every time you let that story play itself out, you basically, and in another sense, it's like the only thing that happens is you get to keep on being like that. It's like you get to be miserable in this particular way for a little bit longer. But if we understand that this simply cannot be permitted. Now, there's no way that you can just stop thinking like that. You can't just say, stop it. You have to replace it with some other reality. you can replace it with a chant, with a prayer, with a mantra. It depends on how strong you are within yourself. Personally, I found that I'm very word-oriented. It just depends on who you are. So I found that replacing it with better words was very helpful to me because I can concentrate on words. And that's the practice of affirmation. And Kriyananda has a book of affirmations. Yogananda has a book of affirmations. Or you can create one yourself. The affirmation needs to be something that you really believe. If you just say something, God is good and everything that happens is perfect, and you don't really have the life experience that really knows that, sometimes an affirmation that's too big for your present reality actually hurts you. Because the more you say it, the more your subconscious mind says, oh, come on, you're kidding. You know, get real, honey. That's just not the way life is. So the affirmation has to connect, has to really connect with your present consciousness and then take it a step further, but not a mountain leap further. A woman friend came to me and she had become ill because she worked in a chemistry lab and some of the chemicals had actually made her ill. She had been on a leave of absence. Now she was going back exactly into the same job. And the affirmation she had is, I am healthy and well, and, you know, nothing affects me. I said, do you believe that? She said, no, you know, immediately. And it was just like, the more she said it, the more frightened she became, because the more it was telling her that she had something terrible to face. I said, why don't you have an affirmation? And we came up with something like, whatever comes to me, I will face it with courage and calmness. And it was like, she felt that courage and calmness was a little more than she had, but she felt it was something that she could affirm. Courage and calmness was at least a possibility for her. So whatever God sends me. And she had a belief in God that whatever came to her came from God. Because it came from God, she could face it with courage and calmness. She didn't automatically feel courageous and calm, but if everything comes from God, then I can face it with courage and calmness. So it was just the right space for her. And as soon as she said that, you could feel that there was power in that. So she started countering, what am I going to do when I get back to work and all these things are going to happen? Everything comes in my life is sent to me by God for my own greater good, and I will face and accept it with courage and calmness. And that was enough to lift her beyond herself, but also to connect with where she was. I used to say an affirmation, I know God's power is limitless. This was out of Yogananda's book. I know God's power is limitless, which I do believe. And as I am made in his image, a little bit of a stretch, but I can still believe it, then I too have the strength to overcome all obstacles. The last one was really a stretch, but I was trapped by the first two phrases. So it went right to the source of my difficulty. Will I be able to cope? And, well, I know God's power is limitless. As I am made in his image, I too have the strength to overcome all obstacles. It didn't take me off the hook. It told me clearly that something was going to be asked of me, and what was going to be asked of me was probably going to be more than I think I can do. So, you see, it was both uplifting and also honest. And it was very carefully selected. I did it for many years, and it really worked. And every time I would get that feeling about the assignment I had, the number of things I had to do, the overwhelming nature, I know God's power is limitless. And if I was alone, I would say it in a loud voice because this is an emergency. Mm-hmm. This anxiety is an emergency. If I was in a crowd, I would say it quietly and I would use all the concentration I had to only think those words. And even if these people were chattering and singing, all these other things were behind me, I would just say, I know God's power, and just concentrate on every word. And at least if I wasn't completely overcoming this, I was pushing my energy in a new direction. And then a few things happen because you're practicing when it's easier. And what do you know? You did get the project done in time. And what do you know? People did come in and help you. And what do you know? It did turn into a horrible disaster, but you just worked it out. And then that begins to build, and then the bigger things get, the big thing comes, and then it's like we had the principles of being an entrepreneur. We'd never started a school, but we knew that certain generic things happen, and every time they happen, this is how you respond. Okay, I've always been afraid that I can't face it, but look, I did. And so this one is something I've never dealt with before, but I know God's power is limitless, and as I am made in His image, everything is sent to me by God and is for my greater good. And with the divine help, I will face it with courage and calmness. And then you try that. And in relatively short order, you'll be amazed how much of a shift you could make. And how much your subconscious mind will begin telling you, yeah, I know you're nervous, but you know, we did it before, we can do it this time. And if you practice when it's easier, when your self-doubt does not have such an upper hand that there's no hope, you'll find that you can be bigger and bigger. Our consciousness is this big. We can expand it like this. Karma comes, and when the karma is just like this, you know, just a quarter of an inch bigger, we find, oh, look, I can stretch that far. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, what happens is the next karmic wave is even taller. But relatively speaking, that's why sometimes people say if you run away from your test, they'll just be bigger the next time. Mm-hmm. They won't necessarily be bigger, but you'll be smaller. Mm-hmm. And so the same size wave, there'll be a bigger difference between your consciousness and it, until finally even tiny things are overwhelming to you. But if every time something comes, you do your very best to expand to meet it, especially if you do that with a dynamic, really powerful flow of energy, what you learn is you learn to expand to meet. You see, these are all principles. You learn to expand to meet. Mm-hmm. Now, the underlying basis of all of this is that God's power is limitless and you are made in His image, and that your inner nature is Satchitananda, and everything else is an imposition on what you really are. And therefore, everything with the right consciousness can be overcome, because there is nothing. That doesn't mean you will succeed. That doesn't mean you will get your desires. That doesn't mean you won't die. All those things will happen to you. But your consciousness will continue to expand. And your consciousness is all you ever have. So it makes no difference what happens to you in life. It matters only what you become through those experiences. Because what you become is really what you have. You understand? Let's take another 10-minute break, and then we'll come back for the end. So if you have any questions or issues we didn't face, let's take the break first, and then we'll discuss them. Okay? Uh-huh.
I am a nurse in the intensive care unit.
And right.
I had this patient that was dealt with three different teams, three different disciplines. Like, the gentleman was in a bed.
Uh-huh.
His history of high blood pressure, so he bled.
Uh-huh.
So there was a neurosurgery, and there was a neurology, and there was what we call intensivists that care for the patient while in ICU. So there were, like, multiple different order.
Right.
And my experience tells me that this patient need to be on a ventilator. We're going to take him for CAT scan and stuff. But the intensivist say, like, we plan to exhibit, do this in, you know, and I'm thinking, like, I'm taking him for CT in the morning, and then the neurology order was, like, give this medication and advance it for this goal. But mm-hmm. normally they will write a minimum dose and a maximum dose. There was no maximum dose except, like, behavior, how the patient calm.
Right.
So after spoken with the intensivist and telling him he's going to win him off the event, and he will exhibit him, and then I just called the doctor, and I called the neurosurgery, and he said, that's not my order, they're pre-medication. And then I realized that was the neurologist's order. And the neurologist was the last person that visited the patient and did some arrangement with his brain.
Uh-huh.
So I went ahead and advanced the pain medication to calm him down. So this guy came in really upset.
Right.
Because he came to exhibit him, like, trying to see if he's awake enough or...
Uh-huh.
And between, I have my colleagues, I have this resource nurse that you communicate with, and the resource nurse was all over my case, like, Tigas, you're an ICU nurse, use your critical thinking, you know, all this belittling.
I
felt like she was really informing me. I could use those judgments. It was more, but I kept telling her, no, I cannot, because he clearly said don't
invest
it because he wants to excavate him. You know that's not going to happen. I said, I do know, that's why I'm discussing it with you guys, but this is what I'm dealing with.
Right.
So, but I end up increasing the pain medication just by a little bit of a dose. And I just the patient came down and when he's calm, yeah. he's still on the bed. He's going to need to be on the bed. So I went for my break and this guy comes in. I just want to say not to paint him in a bad light. He's one of those doctors, he's like all that and he likes to show off, you know, kind of just very powerful, like, you know.
Mm-hmm. Like people can be.
He's like intelligent enough mm-hmm. for him to be in that position.
Mm-hmm.
But he's not mm-hmm. as intelligent as how he talks to people.
Right.
You know? So they said he was, even from this, I was on break, I don't know what happened, but as soon as he walks in, I was like, I hope this guy is awake for me to exhibit him, is what he said. And
mm-hmm.
they all went like, oh.
Mm-hmm.
And it was like, and he goes in, you know, the patient wasn't awake. He was where it needed to be based on the order I saw.
Right.
And I think he said many words, which I wasn't,
mm-hmm.
I didn't hear it, but I come in, I see him, and I was just, don't know, I have my oatmeal.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I just looked at his eyes and he was just like, you know, fidgeting, and I walk in. Tigas, where is my order? I told you this, but that's not what you did. You call around. And then he was like, if you're going to shop around for the order, that suits you.
Mm-hmm.
And I couldn't even put a word, but I'm just like, I am peace. That was
yeah.
what I was like.
Right.
And I've been,
yeah.
I was being told to meditate those things.
Yeah.
Just a day
yeah.
before from some
right.
class. And then I'm looking at him, I am peace. And then he just spoke.
Yeah.
And then I say, Dr. Margolin, so this is him.
Uh-huh.
He didn't show up for an order, like for an order that suits me. The gentleman was awake.
Uh-huh.
He didn't have a good gag, and he wasn't breathing over the vent because it's a higher number. He's
uh-huh.
not going to breathe over it, so I cannot tell whether
uh-huh.
he's breathing too fast. And I increased the pain medication because he was really strong in the right arm, and I noticed his draining was too much.
Uh-huh.
And I made the decision based on the neurology that came and visited him. Yes, he told me this, but I don't think you are going to extubate him because this is what we're planning to do. But I let him speak first.
Yeah.
Like, he even said, like, right now, Tigas, my blood is boiling.
Uh-huh.
I'm like,
yeah.
huh. And I'm just looking at him, and I just, after he finished, I asked, may I speak now? And then
uh-huh.
go ahead.
Uh-huh.
This is basically, this is what happened, this is what I did, I didn't do that.
Yeah.
This is what I thought it needed to be done. And then, but I couldn't even say, we talked about this. So we talked about, you know, don't do that to this, you know, before somebody did that, they have to write each other's up.
Yeah.
And this is ridiculous. We know, you know, that this is not feasible
right.
at all. But I mean, yeah, as a nurse, I'm supposed to say what the doctor does. And this doctor has been extubating patient and where they have to intubate right back.
Right.
Know? So, I got really upset because the resource nurse, I didn't think she was resourceful because
right.
she wouldn't even say, you know, I...
Right, she wouldn't. She wouldn't
she
stand
wouldn't,
up.
You know, and she's that type of person, she wouldn't, you know.
Yeah.
But there was another nurse who was like, Tigas, we don't want you to feel like we put you out. We spoke on your behalf. We told him, you know, yes, that's what you told her. She even discussed it with us. She told us this.
Right.
And, you know, he was like saying, somebody's going to get fired. I mean, who the hell would say that? Things like that. And then the girl said, well, if somebody's going to be written up and fired, she said, you have to take me with her.
Right.
You know, like, I wasn't there when she told him. So she said, Tigas, when he came, he was really upset, but he said this, and we told him, if you're going to accuse her of, you know, not
yeah.
doing your order, you're going to have to accuse all of us, because, you know, what she did.
We all would have done.
Yeah. And it has influenced her decision. But finally, and then I have to call him another time because we did what he wanted us to do. I was like, well, at least try this, turn it off, blah, blah, blah. I'm like, okay, I'll turn it off. His blood pressure shooting up, and he was like giving, you know,
yeah.
like antihypertensive, and I went all the way max. And he goes
yeah.
like, if you want, you could start this other drug too. So I'm putting this patient on two different.
Right.
And I said, okay, and then finally I went way up, and he came down, you know, he was breathing on the CPAP mode.
Yeah.
But not really. And then I called him, okay, you know, he does not have a gag reflex, he follows command, he's awake. Would you want him to be extubated? And I said, no, Tigas, thank you very much, you've done well.
Well, you know what you're saying is, life would be so much easier if there was nobody in it but us. You know, if there was just me and I didn't have to deal with anyone else.
It just felt like, though, at that point, that's my fear too. Always, I don't want to go to work thinking, like, what's going to go down today.
But you see, you must go to work having no idea what's going to happen. I mean, the position of a nurse is to be subject to doctors. Many of the doctors are not enlightened. Many of them are good doctors, but as you said, they don't have the same intelligence toward other people that they have toward medicine. You have a system in which many of the people who are in highly specialized fields have profound egos. That's what drove them to come to that position. They're never trained to get along with people, as if the medicine was not related to people, which is like, duh, who do you think we're practicing medicine on? And it's well known that doctors often don't respect nurses, even though the nurses know more about the patients than the doctors. So basically, that is 100% of the conditions of your position, and you're going to keep meeting doctors like that continuously. So
this time I got lucky, somebody
right.
stepped up, but there will be an incident where...
Right, okay.
You know.
So the worst thing that can happen to you is exactly what you imagine, which is that you will get blamed for some arrogant idiot's mistake, and he'll have more power than you, and he'll take it out on you. It could happen. There's no point in trying to make yourself safe by saying it's not going to happen. It could happen.
Actually, I'm just like, oh my God, he's right there now. He's just going to be...
But it could happen. But you see, your magnetism is going to affect the situation greatly. The children in schools who are bullied are the children who are afraid. And then the bullies look for them. The ones that can't be bullied because they're not afraid, even if they're small and weak. Now, this doctor has power over you, not because he's a doctor and you're a nurse. He has power over you because you're so anxious about what the doctor's going to do to you. Mm-hmm. Now, there's a whole lot of levels of this that are very complicated, and we can start with a few of them. All of your individual patients have their own karma. And all of these doctors have karma with the patients. And you're only one part of this whole reality. Mm-hmm. And that's a very difficult thing to figure out. But sometimes you really have to say that. Ego is a distortion of reality. Mm-hmm. Humility is just seeing things as they actually are. If you're an extremely talented person in a particular area and you say, oh, I'm not good at that, I'm really not good at that, and you know full well you're good at it and everybody else knows you're good at it, it just draws more attention to yourself to pretend it's not true. It's better to say, oh, I'm so grateful that God has given me this gift. I'm so glad you love the music that I did. You know, it's just like, if it was good, it was good. Just look at it. The lack of ego is just realizing that energy flows. And I didn't do it. It's just the energy flows through me. So in your position as a nurse, with the perspective that you have, the training that you have, the knowledge that you have, there'll be times when you'll know things that people around you don't know. But you can only assert them to a certain point. And then the karmic responsibility will be in someone else's hands. And you won't be able to go past that. Because this particular doctor has his own karmic trajectory that he has to play out. He's going to have to kill a few patients with his arrogance before he's going to figure out. And he's only going to kill those patients who are ready to die. They're not going to die because you couldn't convince him. They're going to die because it wasn't their destiny to have your perspective overrule. Now, that's a faith in God, then in your position, is the only answer. Because anything less than that is always going to leave you nervous. You are responsible as far as you can push the energy, but at the point at which somebody else, you know, takes away from you the capacity to do what you know is needed, you have to have enough faith in God to realize I've done my best and nothing more can be done. And that whatever happens is not so terrible. Because whatever is going to happen next is all part of this great web. It would never take place if it wasn't meant to be.
Is that really true, Asha, sometimes? Recently, I'm like, really? Is everything that's happening supposed to be meant to happen?
Well, it's not so much like meant to happen in that, oh, it's all great.
Yeah.
That's my girlfriend saying to Swamiji, it was all perfect. No, it wasn't. He did a stupid thing.
Yeah.
Okay.
But it will happen.
But it will happen. Because just this rug, you know, is made of all these cross currents of threads. And, you know, this was probably made by a machine, but look at all that. and the whole thing is put together, and you can't like just take this little circle and say that that dot is unrelated to everything else. So you take this one man and his blood pressure medication, and you try to make it unrelated to this doctor and the fact that his wife is really mad at him, and he's had an affair with one of the nurses, and she's found out, and she's really mad, and he was always the skinny kid, and now he's showing the others how smart he is, and his father never believed in him, and he's never liked women, and he might even not like Africans, and you know, you can't separate that. You can't just talk about his blood pressure medication. So you yourself have a destiny to do your best. But your best also includes being what Yogananda called this incredible word, incredible phrase, practical in your idealism. You have to also be practical. I've done my best here, and it's just not in the cards for me to be able to do any better. But that's my best. That's fine. Because I do not control the whole world.
Right there, control.
Yeah, I do not control. You have no control.
You
because
can only accept that he is who he is.
Right.
It's acceptance. That's what love is accepting that this man has this ego. Mm-hmm. But you have no control over anything but yourself. And even sometimes you don't have that.
Yeah, but you should not go down lightly. You know, you should go as far as you can go. But then when you're absolutely thwarted, now this is what I've also found, Tigas, and I mean this, because I'm in this position. I've lived in community for 40 years. Mm-hmm. And it's like I often think that something else should happen. And I often have seen, you know, not death, because I'm not in the medical field, but I've seen things go down that I think if people had behaved differently at a different point, it wouldn't have happened like that. And I've often tried to influence it unsuccessfully. But I finally had to realize, you know, the responsibility is not mine. I can't push, because when I start pushing beyond the point of my real responsibility, then I begin to behave out of harmony. And if I'm behaving out of harmony, no good is ever going to come from it. But I've discovered if I remain in harmony, and in harmony does not mean that you don't challenge him, but that when you see that it's not happening, you become practical in your idealism. You back up. You go into silence. Sometimes you can't assent. You can't say a single supportive word, but at least you just don't say anything. And you stop. But often, if you stay in harmony, God will find a way. Pardon me?
I'm counting on the last.
Yeah, but often if you remain in harmony, God will find a way. And if he doesn't, now see everything I've said here this morning, you have to trust that God is in charge, that there is some kind of benign intelligence running the story. If you have no faith in that, we need to go back and start working on that. Because at some point you have to have some faith in something, or else, yes, it's very, very hard to live. If you really think that nobody's in charge or the one who's in charge is a complete moron, then you really are in trouble. I mean, cosmically speaking.
Yeah.
But if anywhere in your life you have seen how the threads weave together and it ends up making a picture that's worth making, you have to cling to that and then keep trying to move it over. Mm-hmm. You know, if it has ever worked out, even when you think it wasn't going to, you have to keep trying to move that over. And that's why you have to practice when it's easier. You have to keep always practice that, oh, look, it did work out. I didn't think it would, but look at all these things that have happened. And if you keep looking for that, then also it begins to show itself to you, because if you're oriented that way, you see it. And yes, I think in your position it would be very challenging. It could be very challenging to be in a life or death nurse, as you are. I mean, you're not just taking care of the measles. You know, you're taking care of things where decisions result in life or death. But life or death is not such a big deal either.
Yeah.
No.
It's not so much been about, not, I'm not saying it in a negative way, it's not so much about the patient life. I mean, the worst thing is that he would be extubated and he won't breathe and he would intubate him. But the whole going through they said, you know, like how he likes to be theatrical. I'm like, I don't want to be on stage, you know.
I'm saying that, theatrical.
Yeah,
uh-huh.
You know, you should know by now. You know, that's, I mean, it's almost real reasoning. as to how he behaved.
Well, when you see someone coming in, I mean, he has a lot of weapons in his hands. He has an automatic repeating rifle in his hand. I mean, talking theoretically, you know, this doctor walks in with an automatic rifle, and you have a pen knife. You know, you have a spoon. You know, you're going to whack him on the arm with a spoon, and he has an automatic rifle. You have to be practical. I can whack him with my spoon a couple of times and see if he's going to respond to me. But when he starts mowing me down with his automatic weapon, I just have to say, oh, okay. It's not my responsibility in a positive sense. It's not my karmic responsibility. Those are the words I use to myself. Mm-hmm. This is not my karma. This is his karma. And if he wants to, you know, do this to me, then what I do, the prayer that I use in a moment like that is not even I am peaceful. I say, oh, Divine Mother, bless us all. Because someone in front of you, he needs prayers as much as you do. So I just say, bless us all. Bless the patient. Bless the other nurses. Bless this poor misguided doctor. You know, bless me, for heaven's sakes. Look at a mess I'm in. And I sort of just quietly... Often I've been in situations where I'm just quietly looking someone in the eyes and they're doing something that I just don't know what to do with, and I'm just saying, whoa, Divine Mother, this is really a mess. What are we going to do? I try to be a little bit inner light, and often quite surprising things happen. You're just like, this is really, what are we going to do about this? Look at this man. Poor fellow, he's completely out of his mind. But he has the automatic weapon and it's trained on you, so... It's really not the time to grandstand. You just kind of hold your little spoon and hope that... Mm-hmm. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah, it does make sense, like sitting down right now. But most of the time, I feel like I'm that little kid that gets picked on.
Yes.
And then, like you said,
Okay, Tigas, you need to breathe.
And I don't want to say that too, because I feel like, oh my God, I said it, and now it's going to happen.
No, okay, now wait a second. Here's something that's very important. You brought up another important point. You have to know what you're dealing with. You can't affirm, you can't use an affirmation instead of a truth. Okay, I, Tigas, feel like the little tiny child who's always being bullied. If that's a fact, you have to say it. It's not negative, and it's not going to create more problems for you to just say what's true. Because you have to have the ego strength to just be able to say, whoa, I am so bad at this. Because if you can't just say, I am so bad at this, you won't work on the right issues. Mm-hmm. You know, if you're working on someone else's karma, you have to work on the right issues. When I finally had the self-confidence to admit how little self-confidence I had, mm-hmm. It was a great, great big day for me. When I said, whoa, you know, I can just let down that whole facade of just having it all together and I can admit that I'm a mess. And it was much more strengthening than all the time I pretended I wasn't a mess. So when you're there and you're feeling like a little tiny child just being beaten up and you've had a, you know, complex background and it's all part of you, you just say to Divine Mother, oh, Mother, I am 2 years old and this is really scary to me. You know, and then you say, you appeal to the source, and while the guy is on you, help, 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 and just cling to something bigger than the one who's attacking you.
Okay, I think that sounds much better.
And breathe. See, now, this has been a very good cycle for everyone, because you see, what we're doing is, we're trying to bring you down to something you can actually bond to. When I was saying you have to have an affirmation that's the right size for you, if your mind rejects it, that's not the solution for you. You just have to keep backing up until you find the one where you're really on solid ground. Doesn't matter how far back it is from the big ideal. You have to be practical. If this is the only place I can stand, then just stand here. And if the only place you can stand is, I get to go home in 4 more hours. At least you just stand there. I can do this for 4 hours, because I can do this for 4 hours is a solid affirmation.
I say, thank God I didn't eat my oatmeal because I would have thrown it up in his face.
That's good, yeah. So you say, thank you, Divine Mother, for not letting me eat first, or else I would be vomiting right now. But you see, that's a positive thought.
Okay.
You see, as long as the thought is positive, it doesn't matter how small it is, because it's all about the direction that you're facing. And if it needs to be tiny, If it's positive, it's your positive. Because you're standing somewhere, and you either orient toward the bad or you orient toward the good, but you're standing wherever you're standing. Pretending you're not standing there, not going to help you. Yeah, it's very important.
And also, you survived this last encounter, and he actually thanked you at the end.
And they were teasing me, like, to get this, you have to call him to keep him posted, because I'm like, I know, and then...
No, but like, your fears came true, and you did fine.
Yeah, that's
so
that's exactly.
Don't have a reason to keep worrying about
that's
it,
exactly the truth. That's exactly the truth. And so you use this experience to tell you, we got through it the last time, we'll get through it this time. You know, these people, these big doctors, are just people who spent a lot of years in school. I mean, they're not different than you. They just studied these certain things, and now they have these positions. And they know a lot about some things and not about others. They're all just different people.
Yeah. I admire his, you know, like his stamina, like how he knows and how he lets you know he knows. I wish I could present what I know the way, you know.
With the confidence.
With the confidence that, like, you know, be culturally, thank you, you know, intimidated. You know, like, I mean, I get intimidated easily by my other counterpart, you know.
Right.
Or I probably won't show my, you know, the knowledge I have.
Right.
Well,
these are the things you say to Divine Mother. Okay, Divine Mother, I'm not as stupid as I appear right now. I mean, these are the conversations you have inwardly. I do know. I do have an answer. I'm just so terrified to present it. Help, 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 help. You know, if somebody's ranting at you, you have a lot of time to think because they're just ranting at you. You don't have to participate. You just, and that's when you just, sometimes somebody will say, oh, Asha, how did you, you know, manage to do that? I say, everything for me is the proof of the power of desperate prayer. You know, just pray desperately and then amazing things will happen.
Okay.
Everything is the proof of the power of desperate prayer. And desperate prayer is totally honest prayer.
Yeah. It's I'm glad you're saying this. Sasha,
yeah.
I felt like, say the opposite in a good way, as if to change what I'm experiencing. And
no, you have to.
Yeah, right, is what I said.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Yeah, right, yeah. That's exactly. When I was having a really difficult time actually writing the book about Swami Kriyananda, the only point of light in the whole situation for me at that time, because writing was the big thing I didn't think I could do, the really big thing. I could cook, I could make costumes, I could do all kinds of useless things, but I couldn't write. So I was certain that I couldn't write, and I realized that I was the only person in my entire universe who thought I couldn't do it. And it was interesting to me, because I thought, these people are not stupid. And they all absolutely believe I can do this. And that actually was the first sort of thing that began to just tunnel in there. It's just that these people are not stupid. It was a very honest... Mm-hmm. I just had to keep backing up. That's how I put it. You keep backing up from perfection until the ground under you is solid. And it doesn't matter how puny it feels, that has to be your starting point. Because anything else is still rocky. Mm-hmm. And you've still got farther to fall. So fall all the way to the bottom, hit the ground, just splat there, lie there as long as you need to, and then rebuild from that. And that's the truth for you. And God doesn't care. You see, we are where we are because of the karmic conditions that we ourselves put in motion. You know, whatever our life has been, I know a little bit about yours, whatever your life has been that's, you know, brought you to this point, that's just where you are. God made you like that. He doesn't care. He only cares whether you're facing toward the light or toward the dark. And it doesn't matter where you are, as long as from that point you're at least hoping to look in the right direction. And there's no secrets. You're not fooling yourself or anyone else by pretending to be more together than you are. Nobody is fooled. I spent a whole, like, 2 years affirming to Swami Kriyananda all these right attitudes. Just a mess. Finally, he smiled at me so sweetly, and he said, "You never fooled me." And I thought, what a complete waste of time. I just had spent so much energy trying to look good. You never fooled me. And then I looked around, and I realized nobody fools me either. You know, when people are putting on, you know it. And it's very unattractive. And it's even worse is, you can't work with people if they're pretending with you. And God can't work with you if you're pretending. And that's why certain teachings are, you know, right enough to sound true and wrong enough to be really dangerous. You know, like too much affirmation that's not connected to reality is actually really very counterproductive. Because you end up so confused. And you're so afraid of really just splat being what you are. So, you know, you can do little things. I mean, when that guy is yelling at you and you're so nervous, I don't know what kind of clothes your family put you in when you were 2 years old, but just imagine yourself in your little play dress, you know, with your little dolly in your hand, you know, just be there. Just be exactly what you are. Just relax into that and then ask God to help you from there. Because if you're only two, it doesn't matter if you look 35 now. You're not. You're two. And just let him help you from there.
Hmm. You know, what's interesting to me is, so you're feeling two.
Uh-huh.
And if you, many times in the world, you express that, and someone will say, oh, that's just negative. That's just negative. Don't think that way. And then they'll say, you should... And then they give you like this big affirmation that is way beyond, and you go,
right.
Yeah, right. Whereas in that moment, they can't, they, you know it, it's true, but for some reason, they won't let you be there.
Because it frightens them.
That's right.
Frightens them.
That's what I'm dealing with right
yeah.
now.
It frightens them. If,
yes.
If you have something that makes you anxious inside, mm-hmm. and it's expressed outside, you have a tremendous desire to get rid of it. Because if it stays out there, it's going
to,
it will bother you.
Right.
That's why the saints are so completely calm. Nothing bothers them. But oftentimes a person imagines that to deal with the inner universe, if I control the outer universe, then the inner one will become okay.
Right.
So they're always time.
Control again. There
it's control.
Control.
Yeah, it's all about control. Now,
yeah, exactly.
There's... This whole business about positive negative is very subtle,
yeah.
because what you really need to be is you need to be humble,
mm-hmm.
okay? And humility is self-honesty.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes people think humility is self-abnegation. Oh, I'm nothing, I'm just terrible, I'm so small, I'm so weak. No, no, you're probably a little weak and a little strong. I mean, you're just the truth. If you're very good at something, as I was saying, you are. It's like it doesn't help anything to say you're not. And if you're not good at something, it certainly doesn't help to pretend that you are. But the fact of the matter is, also about humility, is that God can do anything through you. And you have the potential. You can overcome it. So humility is always, yeah, this really scares the life out of me. I behave like a two-year-old when this happens. But I'm working on it. But you can't teach everybody. Sometimes what you have to say is, oh, wow, that's an interesting idea. That's amazing. Perhaps you're right, you know. There's just nothing else to say.
But you know, there's something truthful. Again, there's a lot of truth
mm-hmm.
in what you said, is that you can't tell them, however it's happening subconsciously.
Right.
And because that's what I'm dealing with my family. I thought when I came here that my sisters and I would be good friends. Well, I scare the hell out of them.
Right.
Because the world is, you know, I'm basically starting over. I basically lost everything,
mm-hmm.
yet I know it's going to be okay. There's fears and all that, but they don't even want to talk to me about it.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I realized not too long ago that that's why, is they are so afraid that it's going to happen to themselves.
Right.
That they are not capable of helping me. Yet I also, and I was thinking about karma, is my coming back here after so many years, there's some karma wrapped in there, too.
Mm-hmm.
I have things to finish up here.
Right.
Before I can really move on to what the next phase is.
Yes, all of those things
yeah.
are undoubtedly true, and they also may be, I mean, you could just be some kind of a rebuke to them on many levels. You can be a threat and a rebuke. And
yeah.
with all due respect, and I know, you know, you're just raising a baby, and we have all these high hopes, physical families are... something, but not everything.
No, you're
you know,
right.
I mean, we have many, many incarnations, and a physical family is just the family that is related to this body.
That's right.
And if you really think in terms of all the incarnations you have, sometimes the people who are in your physical family are also your spiritual family, in the sense of your enduring family over incarnations. Sometimes they're not.
Yeah.
And just because you have these physical relationships does not mean you have real relationships. So you can't just dismiss them either, but no. You don't have to stake your life on it.
Right.
People are just people. You have to look at them and think, just because, again, you see how selfish it is? You're my sister, you're my mother, you're my child, you must.
Uh-huh.
Yogananda said the highest human relationship is friendship, because it's the only relationship that does not have an element of compulsion in it. You know, a mother must take care of her children, a child has an obligation to its parents, siblings have obligations to each other, but a friend is a freely chosen relationship. So all relationships, he said, should be on the basis of friendship. So I often say to, you know, parents, oh, isn't it wonderful that your child has turned out to be your friend?
Yeah.
Which is not always such a popular thing to say, but sometimes they do and sometimes they don't. Mm-hmm. I mean, they can also be your friend as long as they're little, but when they actually come into their own reality, you're not really friends. You would never seek each other out because there's no real basis of affinity there after the body and all of that was done. The parent may still feel, because parents feel that way.
Mm-hmm.
And these are just...
Some don't.
And some don't. And these are just facts.
Mm-hmm.
And they're hard facts. I don't talk about them that much because it did not make friends for me to say some of the things I really feel. So I got such a bad reputation. And then I discovered I had all this karma with my parents I didn't think I had. You know, God got back at me in his own way. I had to learn things I didn't know. But yes, all that you say is exactly true.
You know, the hardest part is, years ago, I, like you, chose to follow spirit.
Uh-huh.
And so to them, I mean, I don't talk anymore about my studies or what I've learned or anything because they cannot accept it.
Well, it's also, you might as well just, you know, lapse into Swahili.
Well, yeah. Well, but they are actually, compared to when I first started studying,
right.
They've really come along.
Uh-huh.
However... It's not so much what I believe or what they believe, it's the way I chose to live that they have a problem.
Right.
And so that, to not be able to share who you are
mm-hmm.
with whoever is around you is one of the most difficult things I think
mm-hmm.
there is. And you talked earlier about the bliss and the joy.
But Patricia, you have to also look at one other element of this. I had to help my parents go through the last years of their lives. I ended up being their caretaker more than I expected to be.
Which I've been kind of to my mom lately.
Yeah, I didn't expect it.
Yeah.
They lived in Southern California, and I was flying back and forth all the time. I never could speak about anything, you know,
mm-hmm.
anything at all. I mean, here I talk all the time. People listen to me. It got to be kind of funny. At one point, my father was just repudiating me so completely, and I began to laugh. I said, this is so funny. I said, you have no idea how many people hang on my every word. It's so refreshing to have someone just think, have no respect for me at all. I mean, it was just like, this is great, you know? Just put the whole thing in perspective. My mother, bless her heart, actually said to me, It was a little bit of being old, but she really meant it. Oh, all those people think you're so nice because they don't know you like I do. Fortunately, you know, it just didn't,
yeah.
At that point, it just didn't affect me. Again, I thought, isn't this wonderful?
Yeah.
I get way too much praise. It's so pleasant just to be insulted, just like. So there wasn't a thread of what I actually thought that I could tell them, not
mm-hmm.
an iota,
mm-hmm.
but I could give them vibrations.
Mm-hmm.
And my mother said things when she wasn't saying things like that. I don't know what it is. I just like having you around. Maybe it has something to do with all that stuff you're doing like this, you know? But not a breath came out of my mouth. They were not interested. It was not helpful. But I just said, okay, here I am, and I need to help them. So just let me just help them. And what I actually did, seriously, is I started helping them instead of trying to be me in their world. They didn't care about who I was, and it wasn't helpful. But if I used what I knew to help them move through their reality, then I was able to feel great satisfaction and be useful to them.
Yeah.
And, you know, feel like, let's not do this again. This was nice. We did it once.
Right,
let's not
right,
do it
right.
again.
Yeah.
But no. They never cared about what I was. They just didn't have the capacity. I might as well have lapsed into Swahili. It wasn't in their vibration to understand mine.
Right.
And it was selfish of me to think that they could.
And it frightens.
it just was, it wasn't, didn't even frighten him. It was incomprehensible. And it was only my ego that felt that I need to be myself. Why do I need to be myself? You know, why do I need to be myself? They don't, they're not interested. So for me to insist on being myself, who am I serving? So it's just like, who am I serving? Well, I'm just serving my need to be myself. Ah, oh, thank you. I think I won't go there. You see, it's very, there's a great deal of false teaching.
Right.
And this is not an easy path. Now, there are times when you say to someone, ha, just this is who I am, take it or leave it. You know, there are moments when the thing to do is to stand up, but it's not nearly as often as people think it is. Yeah, not nearly as often. Now, we have actually reached the end of our time. Is there anything more that needs to be said before we call it a morning? Okay.
Thank you
all very much. That got very interesting. Thank you for coming, all of you.